Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 14th, 2026, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Little versus Hecox and West Virginia versus BPJ, which were argued yesterday before the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Sarah Parshall Perry, who is Vice President and Legal Fellow with Defending Education. Prior to coming to Defending Education, Ms. Perry served as a Senior Legal Fellow at the Edmund Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, where her work centered on civil rights and the proper role of the courts. Before that, she served as Senior Counsel to the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education, where she focused on policy reform, technical guidance, and the Office for Civil Rights annual report to Congress. And prior to her tenure there, she spent 6 years with the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. Also joining us today as our moderator for today's conversation is William Trackman, who is General Counsel for the Mountain States Legal Foundation. Previously, he was appointed to serve in the Department of Education as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office for Civil Rights. And prior to his appointment, he served as General Counsel to Douglas County School District, where he helped litigate their fight concerning school choice in the school district. He also presently serves as Vice Chair in the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights Colorado Advisory Board, as an adjunct professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. And I'll leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Trackman, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Kayla, and thank you to all of our guests today. It looks like we're almost to 100 folks on the line. We've got a spicy one today. If you have a question, go ahead and put it in that Q&A box. Sarah and I talked before we started this, and we said we want the smoke, so don't be afraid to put the questions in the Q&A box. We're going to go about 35, 40 minutes with conversation, and then we're going to turn to the Q&As about Little v. Hecox and BPJ versus West Virginia. Sarah, with that, let's turn it over to you. I don't literally see a champagne bottle behind you right now, but I want to talk to you about first of all, let's get a little bit of the groundwork. These were two cases, both involving trans sports issues. Can you start from the broadest possible base and tell us about what the cases are about?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are two cases. And remember, there was a series of rulemaking procedures that transpired during the Biden administration on Title IX. That made much of the litigation and laws like Idaho's and West Virginia's actually necessary. 27 states have passed laws based on sort of protecting notions of biological reality and sex-based distinctions in athletics. They all followed rulemaking from the Biden administration, expanding the term sex to include gender identity or transgender status within Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. That is very simply the 37-word law that simply prohibits sex discrimination in any federally funded education program. And understanding that the federal government was perhaps not going to apply and enforce Title IX in a way to protect biological girls, many of the state legislators decide they were going to actually step into the fray and legislate in such a way as to do just that, Idaho and West Virginia being among them. Idaho's litigation began all the way back in 2020. Specifically, this is related to Lindsay Hecox, a transgender identified male who identifies as a female, specifically who brought an equal protection challenge only relative to Hecox's participation in college athletics. Hecox did not make any of the organized teams, but did play club sports. And notably, after Scrimeti, which came out last term, the blockbuster and so-called gender-affirming Medicare for minors tried to moot their own case, specifically by filing a suggestion of mootness with the Supreme Court and filing a motion to dismiss with prejudice in the underlying trial court, which was dismissed. So mootness is sort of a unique aspect of the Hecox litigation here that was not present in the West Virginia case. West Virginia's case concerns a challenge by Becky Pepper Jackson, who is now 15, a middle schooler at the time, now a high schooler, who wanted to play organized athletics. And that individual brought a challenge specifically on the basis of Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. So we've got sort of parallel cases here, one in the collegiate format, one in the K through 12 format, one only implicating equal protection, the other in West Virginia implicating both Title IX and Equal Protection Clause jurisprudence. They came to the court. The court heard both arguments yesterday from the Idaho and West Virginia Solicitor Generals, both of whom I thought did masterful jobs during the course of questioning and particularly in their closes. The United States also filed as amicus. And so we heard from Hash Mapam, who is the Deputy Solicitor General for the United States as well, in addition to the attorneys for the ACLU representing both transgender athletes. I will say generally, the press that I've seen up, down, and sideways, regardless of whether or not it's mainstream or conservative or left-wing leaning, all seems to indicate precisely the same thing, which is that it's a very good outcome for the states of Idaho and West Virginia, and that even the liberal justices, to my ear, recognize that these particular petitioners are going to have a relatively high bar to get over. That was, I think, a good portion of what we heard from the liberal justices yesterday, is that they recognize the strength of the state's arguments. And so at this point, they're either trying to find the Idaho case as moot, and so eliminate one altogether from consideration, or narrow the ruling in both cases specifically to determine these are as applied equal protection clause challenges. That's a pretty high burden, I think, to overcome.
Yeah, I want to talk about tea leaves and some of the substance of the argument. But on the posture, I found it interesting that despite, I think you're right, the press saying that the states have the better opportunity here, both cases came to the Supreme Court as losses, one from the Ninth Circuit, which I think was a unanimous 3-0, and then one from the Fourth Circuit, which had initially, the district court had ruled in favor of the state, West Virginia, but then the Fourth Circuit reversed that and held in favor of BPJ. And so were you surprised at the difference between the tenor below, where these challengers had come in as winners, and now facing a much more probing Supreme Court?
Yeah, I anticipated that very much. First of all, the Fourth Amendment, or the Fourth Circuit generally, has been not good on gender identity jurisprudence. In fact, one of the other cases that we saw come to the Supreme Court, on which the Supreme Court denied cert, but would have provided clarity on sort of the issue of transgender identified individuals and bathroom use, was Brim versus Gloucester County School Board. That was coming from the Fourth Circuit as well. They denied cert. And so that sort of Title IX issue specifically, and notions of sex separated spaces within the concept of public education, has already not been well handled by the Fourth Circuit. Remember also that we saw a denial of cert in the case LM versus, or John and Jane Parents 1 and 2 versus Montgomery County School Board, a gender secrecy case, facial challenge coming out of the Fourth Circuit. Again, the Supreme Court denied cert. And the Mahmoud versus Taylor case also came out of the Fourth Circuit. Remember, that was the notion of being able to, as religious parents, opt one's child out of normative curriculum on LGBTQ themes. So many, many times the Supreme Court has gotten cases from the Fourth Circuit. And in fact, fun fact, statistically speaking, the Fourth Circuit was the most overturned by the Supreme Court last term. That does not surprise me in any respect, but they came out, obviously, I think, thinking this was going to be a stronger case for them. But it is very clear from recent Supreme Court jurisprudence, even within the concept of those cases on which the Supreme Court denied cert, that when cert is granted on particular cases coming out of the Fourth Circuit, I give you, by the way, also, and on an unrelated issue, West Virginia versus EPA, in which the Fourth Circuit was again roundly chastised for expanding statutory definitions. Again, we see that the Fourth Circuit has many times, more often than not, and especially so within gender identity, been an outlier in these cases. So it was not a surprise to me. I pretty much anticipated that approach.
let's get into the substance. So because the both cases came as losses, the states went first. And I thought the argument from the Idaho solicitor was very intuitively appealing. The idea that this is not a gender identity classification at all, that it's a sex classification, and not even really a sex classification that the challengers are taking on, because they don't want to get rid of men's and women's sports. They want to change the gateway into who's allowed, mostly into women's sports. Can you talk a little bit about the argument from Idaho in the Hecox case?
Yeah, it was actually a strong argument to lead with, I think, because you can sort of avoid the calculus altogether of whether or not you're regulating based on transgender status or gender, because simply at bottom, what matters here is biological sex. And in fact, when he began his arguments for Idaho, he said Idaho's law classifies on the basis of sex because sex is what matters in sports. It correlates strongly with countless athletic advantages like size, muscle mass, bone density, heart and lung capacity. And the purpose of the state's law is to preserve equal opportunities for women and girls in sports. Denying special treatment isn't classifying on the basis of transgender status. It's consciously choosing not to, which I think was really a brilliant turn of phrase. All Hecox challenges, he emphasizes that the law's application to a tiny subset of males who identify as transgender and have suppressed their testosterone, which might have a blunting effect on their athletic ability. And so what he did was identify rightly for the court that these individuals are really asking for specialized status. They cannot facially challenge the constitutionality of these particular legislative efforts by Idaho and West Virginia. All they're doing here is challenging them based on their own individual characteristics. And that requires an analysis that the Supreme Court has never held to, that as applied challenges in an equal protection clause format would actually require strict scrutiny. And that is something not supported by the case law.
Yeah, I thought, I mean, first of all, the argument turned to this very academic debate early about whether if something satisfies intermediate scrutiny, whether individual people can say, well, yeah, it satisfies intermediate scrutiny overall, but with respect to me, your compelling interest isn't met, or your especially important interest is not met, or it's not adequately tailored. And that was a debate that I had not really focused on before the argument. It seems to me, as you just alluded, that if you could say you win normally, but not with respect to me, that would lead to, you know, myriad lawsuits of individual people saying I'm the exception to the rule. I just hadn't thought about this argument much. I thought Justice Kagan said the authority on this issue is relatively sparse. What do you think of that exchange?
Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, I think the most pointed part about all of these arguments, and it actually transpired with Solicitor General Mapam, in which he was in a colloquy with Justice Jackson. And she actually asked about someone who is transgender, but does not have, because of medical interventions or otherwise, the same threat to physical competition, safety, sort of athletic advantage for all of these variety of reasons. And she asked specifically, why shouldn't that person be able to bring a challenge to the law as it applies to that individual? And Mapam argued that the state was only required to show that there's a substantial relationship between the goal of ensuring fairness in women's sports and the exclusion of transgender athletes. To secure or require a perfect fit elevates the entire calculus to strict scrutiny, which the court has never held, especially and including when considering things based on restrictions for sex, classifications based on sex, to which it is only ever hewed to intermediate scrutiny. So it was really in this sort of exchange, I think, starkly evident that the United States and Idaho as well had specifically identified, listen, you were asking specifically for this court to say that 99% of men are reasonably tailored to fall under the umbrella of the rubric here for Idaho, for West Virginia. But the 1% who take drugs who might have an actual blunting athletic advantage, those are the ones with which we have a problem. Well, that particular colloquy made very clear to me that you're really sort of disfavoring one group over another, and you're unbalancing the equities. McPann had this colloquy with Justice Jackson, in which she was identifying two cases, Lehr versus Anderson and Gabon versus Muhammad, both of which did not support her proposition. This was an absolute watershed moment for me. You know, it's sort of the kind of legal nerd that gets into the weeds on some of this stuff. When he was able to say, Justice Jackson, the two cases that you've identified here do not support the proposition of an as-applied equal protection challenge. One was a facial challenge and one was an as-applied on a completely different basis. It was starkly, I think, effective for me, because she was rendered speechless for a very short period of time. She was very talkative through the rest of the argument, as she does have a tendency to be the most talkative justice. But it really was a finer academic point that I think a lot of us kind of went, wow, we hadn't considered precisely how narrow you would have to get to achieve a victory for these transgender petitioners here, specifically by elevating the calculus to that level that the court has never achieved before.
There was a notable moment, I can't remember if this or this colloquy or another one, where Justice Jackson said okay and then paused for a long time, like it wasn't clear whether she was going to have another question. Yes. It's very rare to hear a Supreme Court just say okay, like okay, you win, you know, like I have nothing more to ask. I also thought that was an interesting colloquy. The other case that Mr. Muppan cited was this Michael M. case about, and just to be candid, I haven't read this case recently. He said it involves statutory rape and the question of whether a different penalty for men versus women was constitutional. And the court said, well, yes, generally, because women can get pregnant, but men can't. But even if the victim of the statutory rape were infertile, that wouldn't mean that the criminal gets off the hook, despite the fact that the tailoring wouldn't be an exact fit for that. I thought that was a very powerful argument, partly because of the facts of the case. You know, it doesn't seem intuitively right that someone would get off the hook for that. What do you think of the Michael M. citation?
No, I thought that was actually very, very helpful. And again, part of the strengthening of the argument here, because what we're doing is we're identifying over and over and over again for 99% of applicants, those individuals who will fall under the rubric of types of laws like this, it will be suitably tailored. It will be sufficient. There will be outliers naturally, but that does not necessarily mean that the law itself has failed to pass constitutional muster. So I think it was very much in keeping with a well-developed series of arguments on these fine, nerdy academic points relative to, listen, you're asking for a perfect tailoring. There will not be a perfect tailoring, and it's not what we're asked to do in constitutional questions of this nature. All we're asking for is a sufficient fit. If you ask us for a perfect fit, that every single instance, 100% of individuals will fall under this constitutional rubric, you've elevated us to strict scrutiny, and that's never been required by equal protection jurisprudence.
Yeah. Just a note that we already have four questions in the queue. So if you want to ask a question, get in on the ground floor.
By the way, let me also add a footnote there. It is required in race cases, but it's not required in sex-based cases. Yeah. So we're only just talking about sex as sort of an equal protection clause analysis. So,
yeah. So let's talk about mootness just for maybe one brief minute, because it did come up in the Hecox case, because after the Supreme Court granted cert, and we've seen this a few times, we saw it with a gun case in 2020, where after the Supreme Court granted cert on a New York gun law, the gun law quickly got repealed. And then the court said, okay, fine, it's moot. And then it happened a couple years ago with this disability case, Atchison. And again, the Supreme Court kind of gave in and said, okay, the case is moot. Here, after SCOTUS grants cert on the question, Hecox comes in and says, despite all my representations in the past about how I plan to participate in sports going forward, I've decided not to do that anymore. And I want you to dismiss this case all the way down under Munsingware, reverse my victories just to get out of this. And what was your thought on how the court responded to that and whether that has a chance of succeeding?
You know, it's interesting. I thought that they were going to dispose of this very sort of discreet procedure before we got to oral arguments. I was a little surprised that the justices granted the opportunity to actually argue this during oral arguments and didn't summarily dismiss the suggestion of mootness or deny the request to actually vacate the case Again, procedurally speaking, Hecox had already in the trial court moved to dismiss the underlying complaint with prejudice. But again, we're talking 4 years of litigation. And interestingly, I can't but turn a little bit of a sort of suspicious eye toward this. The suggestion came specifically after the court rendered its decision in Scrimeti. And I do think from a strict litigation standpoint, this was reading the tea leaves. It was a bit of the writing on the wall. The only justice who seemed interested in the question of mootness. And again, I think this goes to the sort of attempt by Kagan Sotomayor and Jackson to at least cabin what they see as potentially a very broad application. In other words, upholding ostensibly the constitutionality of not only these two states' laws, but 25 other state laws. The only justice that seemed really interested in the question of mootness was Sotomayor herself. And she wanted to essentially provide an opportunity, get get out of jail free card, right? So you've expended all of these dollars and hours of manpower, and there have been hundreds of thousands of dollars of state taxpayer money wrapped up in defense of the litigation. So to file a request for Munsingwear vacator at that point, to my mind, and I think the attorneys at ADF who intervened with their plaintiffs as well, felt the exact same thing. Their briefing represented that as well. It was a sort of strategic effort at gamesmanship. I don't think all is considered. The fact that it got such little attention during oral arguments, I think speaks volumes in that it will probably be a footnote in the majority opinion who Justice Roberts may assign to somebody like Barrett.
Yeah, I agree. I was personally offended on behalf of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 41 that they tried to dismiss this case so late in the game. You know, I'm usually an absolutist when it comes to Rule 41. A plaintiff is allowed to say goodbye whenever they want to. Here, when it's such obvious gamesmanship, I can't imagine that benefits the party and really undercuts all the other plaintiffs who say, well, we would love to invoke Rule 41, but here you're abusing it. So you're making it harder for us.
Right. I think that's one of those situations where we really have an opportunity to say, OK, we want you to get every bit of procedural relief to which you are entitled. But when you have gotten to the point where you are literally right up to the court's edge and you're saying, OK, just kidding, we're not going to play this year. And first of all, any affirmation at this point, one has to take, again, with a skeptical eye. We understand the impact, on sort of, it being deleterious on an individual's mental health for reasons that being in the public eye in litigating cases like this can be challenging for many individuals. And this is a young person. And I think there was a lot of sensitivity to things of that nature, particularly from Justice Kavanaugh, who had a couple of very interesting things to say, and we can talk about those in a little bit, about the nature of athletics itself, right? And how you really want to promote fairness and equality, and things like roster slots matter and feelings matter and whether or not you get cut or recruited. These things matter. And in no less case does that matter for Hecox here. However, from a strategic standpoint, I think the ACLU attorneys specifically knew what they were doing. They saw the writing on the wall, and it was an attempt basically to circumvent the court's ruling in this case.
Yeah, let's put Mundus in a box, because I agree with you, it's probably not going anywhere. Let's talk about the respondent, who is the prevailing party below in Hecox, and the questions from the court that their attorney received. What was your impression? Because they were fighting uphill, right? They just had two very good advocates come in and I think persuade a lot of the justices to their side. What did you make of the respondent's argument?
Yeah, it's very interesting because Alito really, and Kavanaugh as well, but Alito was sort of anticipated to be sort of the hot button justice. He has no problem getting fiery in some exchanges, especially on issues of this nature. He did so in Mahmood. He's done so in Scrimeti. He's done so in Dobbs. He really has no problem going right to the heart of the issue. And specifically, he looked right at Kathleen Hartnett for the ACLU, who represented one of the prevailing parties below, and specifically said, for equal protection purposes, what does it mean to be a boy or a girl or a man or a woman? Now, this is a fundamental question, because they had specifically asked, don't categorize our claimants on the basis of whether or not they are boys and girls. Simply look at whether or not they have athletic advantages. Well, for purposes of both equal protection analysis and Title IX analysis, you have to kind of understand what that means. So that's exactly what Alito was getting to. He said, what does it mean to be a boy or a girl, a man or a woman? And what she said was, we don't have a definition for the court. That was another one of those bombshell moments where I thought, you know, we're talking about regulation based on biological sex. And when pointedly asked by one of the sitting justices, what is your definition of sex? Even though it's very clear, and we can talk about Title IX in a second, but for at least purposes of equal protection clause jurisprudence at the Supreme Court, sex has always meant men and women. And listen, you know, I'm going to quote again, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg from United States versus Virginia, the VMI case, in which she said physical differences between men and women are enduring, but they are cause for celebration. And you can't sort of fungibly switch from one group or another or intertwine them without changing the composition and the regulation of the whole. That's exactly, I think, where we were here. There weren't a lot of legs to stand on for the ACLU attorneys in the case yesterday. And the fact that Kathleen Hartnett could not, on questioning from Justice Alito, actually provide a definition of sex made it very clear it's virtually impossible to understand how we are to regulate these cases.
Yeah, Justice Alito's questioning can be deadly if you're not ready for it. I wasn't sure why she wasn't ready for that question, because that was an obvious question. And then to give the line, we don't have a definition for the core. I mean, that immediately became one of the headliners coming out of the oral argument.
Yeah.
Let's move to BPJ. Now, BPJ is a little bit different because it involves both Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause. What differences did you notice in the arguments, or did you feel like they were pretty much the same arguments?
There were similar arguments, to be sure, but there was naturally, and I anticipated this, especially so from Gorsuch, who is the author of Bostock, right? The opinion, again, in Bostock 2020 was specifically related to employment law and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in that decision. He wrote for the majority, and he wrote that to discriminate, to hire or fire, and specifically here it was an individual who was fired based on transgender status and two employees who had been fired based on their sexual orientation, to fire them based on sexual orientation or transgender status was a sort of impermissible discrimination on the basis of sex, because sex was the underlying characteristic. It was the but-for cause. And again, he botched textualism, and I could wax poetic on this, and you've heard me do it. He botched textualism from the standpoint that he took sex as a fulcrum, understandably, because in 1964, we know what sex meant, and then went to attitudes and behaviors. In other words, if a man dresses like a woman and he's terminated, but a woman who dresses like a woman is retained, you've discriminated on the basis of sex. That, to my mind, was the ignorance of the ordinary acceptable meaning of the term in 1964, as pointed out by Thomas and Kavanaugh and Alito in their dissent from Bostock in 2020. Setting that aside, I was most pointedly interested in what he had to say. And he came immediately out of the gate talking about de jure discrimination against transgender individuals based on family law and immigration status. Not our finest hours, as Justice Gorsuch pointed out. But I will tell you that that colloquy that he had in the exchange with Ms. Hartnett indicated to my mind, we might have a bigger problem on our hands with the application of Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. Again, very simple statutory prohibition on sex discrimination in federally funded education. It's only 37 words long, but we had to dig a little bit into the congressional history, which again, as somebody who's a nerd on this issue like me, I was super excited because they didn't just talk about what Congress meant in 1972, but when Congress came back again with the Javis Amendments in 1974 and the athletic regulations, they had an opportunity to determine whether or not in 1972, Congress meant exactly what it said. And it was the full sense of Congress then in 1974 that, yes, we got it right in 72. There was no modification, manipulation, change of the language of sex to include gender identity. And so that came in a very unique way, because we went from the constitutional analysis for equal protection and the 14th Amendment into the statutory analysis. So really, for somebody who has been kind of following this issue, like you and I have, it was exciting to see it sort of walked all the way through to its natural terminus here. It is very clear that Title IX nor its implementing regulations do not prevent states from separating sports based on biological sex. It's not only common sense, it's supported by the congressional history, the congressional record, the floor speeches, the versions of legislation that went back and forth between House and Senate chambers. There's plenty to rely on in this particular statutory context that indicates there's nothing preventing Idaho or West Virginia from actually doing what they're doing right now. I think it's actually one of the stronger arguments they have.
You've made the point a couple of times that so much of this language is very, it can be very confusing. So Even the justices were kind of buying into the idea that there is a thing as a, you know, a trans identified person who is a biological boy, but then identifies as a girl. And that's a different thing than a biological boy who doesn't do that. Or the word cisgender came up, or even just cis, I think came up. What do you make of both the like subtle struggle between the parties not to buy into the language of the other side, and then the justices kind of looking beyond that and not really being careful about their words?
You know, that's interesting. That's kind of where I felt like the ghost of Bostock hung in the air. It was never invoked during the course of oral arguments, which did surprise me a little bit. I thought at one point we were going to hear from either one of the attorneys for the transgender petitioners that they had to apply Title IX, at least for West Virginia's sake. Title IX was equivalent to or substantially similar to Title VII. And in that way, yes, sex was the underlying regulator, but you've relied on attitudes and behaviors. That's an impermissible form of discrimination. We know that's not the case, but it would have been an argument that I would have anticipated hearing. But that is where I really felt like sort of we got that shadow crossing over us, especially so with Justice Barrett, which was a little bit of a disappointment to me. There were quite a number of Q&A sessions between she and Mr. Block, who was representing Becky Pepper Jackson, in which she utilized the terms transgender girl or transgender boy. And she talked about the fact that transgender girls were being prohibited from competing with cis girls, but that transgender boys were not being prohibited from competing with cis boys. One kind of gets a little tied up in their minds when you're trying to clarify exactly what they mean. I think it unnecessarily complicated the language. Some of the justices had no problem using biologically accurate terms, like Justice Alito himself. I don't think it was necessarily a concession that was the language that the petitioners for the transgender athletes, their particular briefing had included those terms. I think it was simply a nod to how they had argued the case individually. It was a preference that I would take umbrage with. I don't necessarily think it is the job, a sitting justice, to actually take what appears to be an implicit perspective on the notion of sex as being fungible, as being something different and distinct from gender identity or transgender status. I don't think in the end it's going to matter much. We may see language in the opinion that we don't like, and I'm prepared for that. But I think my biggest surprise there was Justice Barrett.
Yeah, I agree. So much of this is tied up, like the rhetoric and the narrative is tied up in the merits of the case, because whether you use the pronoun for the person's gender identity or not implicitly acknowledges, okay, you have switched, right? And so maybe you're entitled to a different sports team. What, I'm switching gears a little bit though, what did you think of the comparison between boys who are just not very good at sports and trans identifying girls who are biological boys, and how you could possibly distinguish the two? I also, you know, felt a little offended that they kept talking about boys who are not very good at sports. But what is the best argument from the challengers as to why their theory wouldn't mean that the floodgates are open, that the girls' sports would now just be full of boys who couldn't make the boys' team?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I really have a hard time finding the strength with that. This is why we regulate athletics based on sex, because sex matters in sports. Naturally, biological, physiological differences come with certain inherent advantages. It also doesn't mean that every boy is going to be a Michael Jordan and every girl is going to be a Serena Williams. We set these standards so that there is a logical, rational, sufficient basis to separate individuals who are not similarly situated and give them the opportunity to have the most equal access, the opportunity to succeed educationally and otherwise in athletic competitions. I really have a hard time finding that to be even a defensible argument on the part of the transgender petitioners in this particular case, because really, once you start parsing out these individual cases where, okay, what about a boy who is cis, identifies as a boy, and really stinks at basketball, and wants to play on the girls' basketball team because he's just really bad. And Justice Thomas pointed this out. You really, there's no difference here, right? Just because an individual identifies as being a girl, whether or not they identify as being a girl and want to be on the girls' team, or identify as being a boy and are a boy and still want to play on the girls' team, you're dealing with the exact same problem. And so because of that, it's very hard to defend the petitioner's arguments in that case.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it was on, so on the one hand, the challengers were saying, well, look, your interest here is in competitiveness.
Right.
And so
right.
Our clients aren't as competitive as biological males who are playing in the male league. They're biological males, but because of the fact that they've suppressed that advantage, now your interest fades away. But it's very hard to make that argument and then say the next person who comes in and says, well, this person, you can just look at them and they don't have the advantages of Michael Jordan. So let's let them in too. It's hard to shut that gate once you've opened it.
Yes. Yeah. And that's part of the problem with creating what these actual transgender athletes have requested, which is we want to create a subclass of individuals who are sufficiently protected and for whom this as applied challenge is going to succeed. Once we kind of let that horse out of the barn, it's very hard to corral that again. And then we've got states who are in the process of trying to make all of these sort of determinations, and all of the legislative determinations thus far, again, 27 states are going to be second guessed, because of course there will always be an exception to the rule, but it is not a perfect fit. That's not required. It is sufficiently sort of acceptable. It is 99% application. And yes, we understand there will be 1%, but that is why we don't break the paradigm of equal protection jurisprudence, for example, and create new subclasses of individuals. And again, you know, it's very interesting to me because Gorsuch used the terminology of discrete and insular minority. That's something that we leave for race and national origin and sex. It's never been used within the standpoint of transgender status or gender identity. And it's very interesting because it wasn't addressed in the Scrimeti decision. This is, again, the so-called gender-affirming medicine ban coming out of Tennessee and restricting these procedures for individuals under the age of 19 and who have certain diagnoses for gender dysphoria. That did not come up, even though equal protection was at issue in the Scrimeti decision. But Barrett, interestingly enough, said, I want the court to be honest about what it's doing. We are regulating on the basis of transgender status. But even if we are, there is no heightened scrutiny review here because we've never identified a new suspect class of individuals sufficient for heightened scrutiny. Right. We have been asked to do so with poverty, with mental disability, with advanced age. We have turned it down time and time again for the better part of 60 years. We're not going to recognize a new suspect or quasi-suspect class sufficient to automatically bump us up to intermediate scrutiny review. And these petitioners are actually going a step further and saying, okay, but also we really aren't great at sports because we blunted our athletic advantage. So now maybe we could go to strict scrutiny and actually jump all the way to the highest tier. So all of these sort of building blocks together, to my mind, indicate that there is a very, very, very narrow path to victory for these two athletes.
Yeah. One question that the advocates got is there room for California to open the floodgates under the Equal Protection Clause? And I thought Mr. Mupon again said, not under Title IX. We don't think that the Equal Protection Clause does preclude a state from letting trans athletes into the other sports league. But equal protection, so equal protection lets them do that. I thought it was an interesting response.
I did too. And here's why I think this is very interesting and why I'm sort of inclined to agree with him here. And Gorsuch is the only one to address the nature of Title IX as spending clause law, passed pursuant specifically to Congress's spending authority, which of course works in the nature of a contract between the federal government and a state recipient, and yeah, in which there must be clear terminology. So it's very clear to me, based on the Constitution Supremacy Clause, the fact that Title IX has operated for, you know, 53 odd years as this sort of bulwark against sex discrimination, was the sort of crowning jewel of the women's liberation movement, their achievement in achieving true educational equality. equality, it's very clear that when contrary laws, and we're seeing this right now, there's litigation happening in the First Circuit between the Department of Justice and the state of Maine, because Janet Mills decided she would throw down and go, you know, toe to toe with the administration on whether or not Title IX required her to separate her sports in Maine between boys and girls, and also with Governor Gavin Newsom and the California Interscholastic Association Federation out in the Ninth Circuit. So DOJ is already embroiled in active litigation on the notion of Title IX requiring equality for the sexes, and that means separating sex by sports. Equal protection jurisprudence, again, related but different calculus from a constitutional standpoint, but I do think it's pretty clear that when Wenmapan came out and said specifically Title IX would prohibit, you know, California from going whole hog and anybody plays on any team, regardless of any gender identity, I would agree with him on that.
Okay. Well, I think we have quite a few questions in the queue. So why don't we turn to those? Well, look, let me turn to the questions. But first, let me ask you, give me your hot take. Is this going to be 6-3, 7-2? How's it going to turn out?
You know what? I would say 6-3. But interestingly, it's, I think, one of those situations. I don't think we've got any swing from the conservatives. I do think the 6-3 vote is pretty standard. If we have anybody, it's going to be Sotomayor, because even she seemed receptive to the Title IX arguments that were made by the West Virginia Solicitor General, in which he identified what Congress meant in 1972 and 1974, and the fact that clearly West Virginia is not violating Title IX by actually separating their athletics based on sports. So she would be my only potential swing. It's very clear where Jackson and Kagan are coming from. If we're lucky, we get 7-2, but I think 6-3 is a pretty solid guess.
Okay. All right. First question. Is there any legal theory by which the court avoids defining sex, but still rules in favor of Idaho and West Virginia, despite not having to come out expressly in defining sex?
You know, I don't think they'll actually have to identify what it is for their purposes. They will simply have to identify what it is for purposes of the statute in Title IX, which is very clear. Gorsuch is going to be very, I think, instrumental in shaping that definition, because even in the Bostock determination, he began with the sentence, which is often overlooked, I think, by people who get right to the end and say, well, they said that sex and gender identity were the same in Bostock. No, they didn't. In fact, the Supreme Court's never determined sex and gender identity or transgender status are similar to or identical to one another, simply that they are interrelated, because sex is the fulcrum on which the entire statute's operation rests. So they won't need to come up with their own sort of ex nihilo definition of sex, but they will look to the congressional record and the history for purposes of Title IX specifically, and what they have said in the past in their equal protection jurisprudence about the nature of what sex is. And those will be cases like Frontiero versus Richardson, U.S. versus Virginia, Godoldig versus Aiello, all of the cases that specifically regulated based on constitutionality of sex distinctions, whether or not they were sufficient to meet intermediate scrutiny. So they'll look to what they have said, not necessarily what sort of they want to say about the nature of sex.
Yeah. Next question. We should take this together. What is the definition of sex for the federal government? And do you expect it to be different after the Supreme Court ruling?
So, well, yeah, go ahead. I will start and I will fill in.
So the 2020 Title IX rule that both Sarah and I worked on that was promulgated under the Trump administration talks about how Title IX presupposes a definition of sex that is purely biological, that relates to your physical traits and your functionality as a man or a woman. And that is repeated over and over again in both the statutory language and the regulatory language. So they talk about the mother-daughter dances versus the father-daughter dances, right? There's one sex and then there's the other sex. There's, you can have a dormitory for one sex if you have one for the other. So there's an obvious dimorphism, binary, male and female idea that permeates throughout all the regulations, despite not having expressly a definition of sex. And I did think it was interesting. One of the lawyers for the challengers said, there's no definition of race either, right? So what do you expect from me? So I thought that was interesting. How do you expect there to be, one way or another, a definition of sex after this ruling?
You know, again, I think it kind of goes back to what did the original drafters of the legislation mean at the time of enactment, right? And we take into that sort of the entire comprehensive view of the congressional history, the record, the result of the litigation, right? We understand, again, Title IX was the result of the Women's Liberation Movement. They were unsuccessful in the Equal Rights Amendment, but they did secure Title VII and Title IX, both of which were watershed pieces of legislation specifically related to workplace and educational equality. And I think they'll be tasked precisely with taking what it meant then. And I suppose my hope is, in the absence of, again, the sort of ex nihilo definition of sex, that is, we are saying, as the justices sitting together, sex means X, Y, Z, they will simply be tasked and rather cabined by the nature of what, up to this point, the Supreme Court has said in equal protection jurisprudence and under Title IX. And again, I think the regulations, I think the history, and in this way, Title IX's application, I think, is an easier, more cut and dry application than it is for even equal protection jurisprudence, because the court, in all of its sort of watershed decisions on sex-based discrimination and sex-based regulation in those particular series of cases that I mentioned, presumed going forward that these were male and female. They didn't have to define sex at all. It was understood to be, as a matter of common parlance, and everything from the 60s to 70s to 80s to 90s, when all of these cases actually came out sort of as a result concurrent with the Civil Rights Act and sort of as a result of ensuing litigation therefrom, that sex was male and female. They've never had to define it on their own terms as a matter of first impression, because it's only ever existed as a nature, sort of a reality that has been commonly understood. It's the same way that we understand, for example, and I'll draw sort of a rough analogy here, parental rights as being pre-political, natural, and inherent, simply by virtue of what we know about human beings, right? Parents have the right to direct the care, control, and custody of their children, because they're their parents. There are certain things that we didn't believe we would ever at any point have to define. Here I am 27 years into the practice of law, and the fact that we had actually an attorney from the ACLU say, I don't have a definition, Justice Alito, on what sex means, but you know, we're not really concerned about that. We just want to know if that sex definition or that sex distinction is actually going to make a difference here. And we argue it doesn't, because, you know, athletic advantage has been blunted. So these are very strange questions. So I don't think the court will, again, as a matter of first impression, say this is what we say sex is. I think it will simply say we have held in this series of cases for equal protection and in this series of cases on statutory analysis that sex means male and female.
Yeah, there are plenty of cases where the Supreme Court says something like only women can get pregnant, right? Or in the Dobbs dissent just a few years ago, the dissenters said this decision will impact women. Women are going to suffer. Women are, you know, the ones who get pregnant, and the women are the one who have a right to an abortion. So it's definitely clear that there's a biological link for the Supreme Court, even if they don't come out and say, okay, here's the dictionary definition of sex. Next question. This, I don't think, question came up during the oral argument, but I have seen Senator Cruz ask this question at a hearing before. One question no trans advocates ever answer: why are there separate sports for men and women? Has that question been fleshed out in litigation?
That's a great question. I haven't seen it personally, but, you know, we saw again with the sort of history of Title IX itself and the progenitors, sort of the first wave feminists who pushed for the passage of Title IX, their desire. And again, I'm just going to give you a little bit of, again, nerdy, willfully admit, history. Susan Hollander in 1971 actually sued her high school team. She was a Connecticut high schooler. She couldn't run with the boys. There was no girls track team, so she ran with the boys. And the result of that litigation was actually kind of the spurning moment for passage of Title IX ultimately. And it led to the now infamous commentary from the judge who authored the opinion, summarily dismissing her case, that we need athletic competition. We need athletic character in our boys. We don't need athletic character in our girls. Well, that's all the feminists had to hear in 1971, and they all marched on Washington to be able to get educational equality passed. And I have benefited from it, as is my daughter, who is now on a college volleyball scholarship herself as a freshman. So clearly, good has been done as a result of all of these sort of statutory separations of particular areas. But I think we can harken back to what Justice Ginsburg said in U.S. versus Virginia, which is men and women are differences. They are different. We can celebrate those differences. They are unique. they're not fungible. We can't switch them out and expect the calculus to be particularly the same. So I think why we have athletic sort of separated sports is commonsensical for those of us who recognize inherent physiological distinctions between males and females, regardless of how those identify, you know, those individuals may identify. Really, when you get down to it, I go back to Alan Hirsch and Williams's arguments as Solicitor Generals from Idaho and West Virginia, which is transgender status, their self-identity is really immaterial to what we're talking about here. We're talking about distinctions based on biological sex because there are inherent physiological distinctions that cannot even be blunted with the effect of hormone suppressing drugs. Boys will naturally be taller. They will naturally have a greater wingspan. They will have natural bone density and muscle mass greater than that of a woman. That makes, for purposes of our discussion today, really the notion of transgender status or gender identity irrelevant to the distinctions at hand.
Yeah. Next, why do we use the phrase biological sex? Isn't that redundant? There's only one.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I would say I can self-chastise here. I really try not to do it because it is redundant ultimately. But I think we have fallen into this notion, again, when we're talking about progressive versus conservative viewpoints on this type of jurisprudence, when hot button politically contested issues are involved. And I'll drop a footnote here. Kavanaugh was the one to say, we're not going to second guess the legislatures. Don't make us constitutionalize this issue, just like we did in Dobbs, just like we did in Scrimeti. We're going to leave these kinds of questions, which, yes, also implicate questions of scientific advantage, right? There's varying degrees of information on whether or not hormone suppression actually has a sufficient enough effect to blunt athletic advantage. Don't make us, sitting together as nine justices in Washington, D.C., have to make those judgment calls. They're already being sifted and weighed in the state houses. Can we just let the political process work its way out? I try not to utilize biological sex, but I think this is a function of the fact that we really, from the Obama administration into the Biden administration to a much more aggressive degree, we saw sort of the implication and the inclusion of language on cis and trans students sufficient that I think a lot of us felt the need to immediately distinguish our line of rhetoric and reasoning by utilizing terms like biological. But yes, I agree with the commenter. It is entirely redundant and I should do it less.
It was probably B. I don't know. Okay, next question. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of the states, what will that mean for the states that go the other direction? We talked a little bit about what the advocate said, but I could definitely see the opinion having language in it that would boost the DOJ's suits against Maine and other states. What do you think are the sorts of language that might be included in an opinion like this that could have a reverberating effect next year or the year after on states that say, oh, it's open season, feel free to join whatever league you want?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Really insightful. You know, it's naturally going to have a direct impact on the 27 states that have legislated the exact same way that Idaho and West Virginia have, which is to say they can probably take a deep breath because no plaintiff in their right mind with an opinion that is going to sort of uphold both of these two state laws is going to decide they're going to waste litigation expense, time, effort, and energy in trying to relitigate issues that have largely already been settled by the Supreme Court. Now, there will be future litigation. I am entirely certain of this. Just as we have predicted in many respects, Mahmoud versus Taylor, this is again the religious parent opt-out case that was the application of Wisconsin versus Yoder. That's going to be a situation where more litigation will come. And by the way, it already has started because now we're seeing requests from religious parents to opt out of things like anti-Israel curriculum as a violation of their sincerely held religious beliefs. Some of these cases, you know, not all of this at the Supreme Court is going to be tied up with a neat red bow. We wish it were because we'd like to put sort of a capstone on what has been a long journey toward sort of the limitation on biological reality as sort of inherent, immutable biological truth. We don't want to have to keep fighting these battles. But I think part of this is the fact, and again, I speak from the standpoint, as you do too, I'm sure, the fact that there is an active Title IX regulation for the Biden administration still in the Federal Register. And until we see, for example, the Department of Education rescind that rule and make a new rule clarifying that Title IX their definition of sex actually means sex and not transgender status or gender identity. We're going to be fighting these battles continuously, because what we're seeing in states like Maine or California is they are either relying on faulty interpretations that are still unfortunately actively in the Federal Register, or they're relying on contrary state law. And that's the point at which you get butting up against the Supremacy Clause and the fact that federal law preempts state law when federal law's congressional intent and purpose would be frustrated by contrary state law. We're going to see more legislation or litigation. I do think it's going to buoy the attempts right now the Department of Justice has, both in the First Circuit and in the Ninth Circuit. It might cause legislators who might otherwise have wanted to essentially legislate in such a way or to invoke policies that are kind of open season athletic regulations. It might give them, I think, pause. Some of them might want to wait until they believe there's going to be a more favorable presidential administration that is keen to say, you know what, now we're going to play more regulatory ping pong, and we're going to go back to the Biden era interpretation. We're going to remake a rule, which I hope doesn't happen. It would be nice to have clarity once and for all of what Congress did mean. I'm hoping for that actual precise clarity in the Hecox and West Virginia versus BPJ cases, in which the Supreme Court says, listen, we know what Congress meant in 1972 and in 1974. We're just going to come out and say it. And in that way, maybe that gives, you know, sort of more progressive legislators who might have said, hey, we're going to have a transgender identified males can play in girls teams law passed. Maybe they might want to second think that.
Yeah. We got about 3 minutes left. Next question pushes back a little bit on the idea that there isn't an equal protection right to fair and competitive sports leagues. If the government, say a public school, is going to set up a sports league in such a way as to make men's and women's teams, why should California be allowed to say, yeah, the men's team will be for men and the women's team will be for both women and males who identify as female?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think, if I had to kind of get inside the mind of the principal deputy solicitor general, Mappan, what he was essentially saying is, listen, we're asking you, Supreme Court, not to recognize this new subset of individuals, this new class of individuals in an as-applied Equal Protection Clause challenge requiring heightened scrutiny, right? Elevated scrutiny, strict scrutiny. But that's not to say that California can't do the same thing. There may be individual plaintiffs there who say, listen, we're going to make that argument. And maybe the Ninth Circuit decides, you know what, we're going to buy it. We're going to say that, yes, the law works for 99% of individuals, but in this as-applied Equal Protection Clause challenge, we're going to let these particular plaintiffs succeed because they've proven for XYZ reasons, or maybe because there's a more fulsome factual record or scientific experts have been called to testify that, yes, hormone suppression, puberty blocking have had a significant enough effect so that there isn't any kind of deleterious impact on women's equality and education. You know, that's my strongest argument. I'm using air quotes here because it's a matter of judicial interpretation. You know, I disagree with it, but I do think the Title IX argument is stronger to require sex-separated sports simply because we have the benefit of all the congressional history. And the Supreme Court, nor should any court, be in the matter, in the business of second-guessing the reasoned judgment of a legislative body. That's why we have separation of powers. There is only, under Marbury versus Madison, the purview of these federal courts to say what the law is, not what they would want it to be.
Yeah. So we've got about a minute left. So I'll take the moderator's privilege here. One thing that Justice Kagan was very concerned about was, what if we put something in this opinion that's going to be used as a weapon in a future case related to trans issues? And I think that is a very, very reasonable concern, because I think these issues are going to keep popping up. And I would love your take on what's next out there. I know that there are some parental rights issues coming up about secret gender transitions. What else is on the horizon in the gender space?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, it is so sort of timely and concurrent with everything that we're hearing right now. You know, we'd like to think, oh, we're done with the gender identity issue. We've heard oral arguments on Charles versus Salazar. We've already got the opinions in, you know, the Mahmoud versus Taylor case, the Scrimeti decision. We've obviously heard oral arguments in the sports cases. We're not done yet. And in fact, I would not be surprised if we see a cert grant in what I sort of colloquially call these gender secrecy cases. These are school policies that explicitly hide, they obfuscate gender identity information from custodial parents about these minor kids under the guise of not forcibly outing these children, which puts teachers, administrators directly at odds with parental custodial control and the care and upbringing of their children. Interestingly, right now there are two cases, one out of the First Circuit and one out of the Ninth Circuit or 11th Circuit, rather, both of which consider the constitutionality of these parental rights challenges on an as applied basis, but as applied because the facial challenges that came out of the Fourth and the Seventh Circuit and the Tenth Circuit previously were all directly related to, we're challenging it. There can never be a constitutional application of this. These are individuals who are coming and saying our children were socially transitioned behind our backs. Yeah. Concurrent with all of this, in a case called Miravelli versus Bonta, and that's coming out of the Ninth Circuit, Thomas More Legal Society is bringing that case. They have actually asked the Supreme Court in an emergency petition to vacate the stay from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that has actually required it. Originally, the lower court decision required notification to parents. The Ninth Circuit said, nah, we don't think so. We're actually going to stay that opinion from the lower court. Thomas More has now said on an emergency basis, we would like you to vacate it. So this is not over. Their response is due on the 21st. We could actually see a cert grant on two or more of these cases before term's end.
Wow. Wow. Well, it's been a privilege and an honor to speak with you. I'm going to turn it back to Kayla.
Thank you both so much. We really appreciate you taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight and for this fabulous discussion. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our websites and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.